This morning we are moving across the Jordan River. We've had two chapters so far where a lot of things have happened. God has promised to never leave Joshua. He's promised to establish Joshua as the ruler of the people of God as Moses was. We've seen two spies go into Jericho, and the great doctrine of faith alone has been brought forward in the person of Rahab. But now, we're crossing the Jordan. We have to be very careful when we cross the Jordan River. Why do we have to be very careful? Because what's going to happen whenever we cross the Jordan River is an entire massive can of very violent worms is going to be opened. As soon as we cross the Jordan River, the next many chapters of the book of Joshua are conflict. Conflict. So this is a very important text, the crossing of the Jordan. It's the second time since Genesis that the Lord, in his sovereign providence, has chosen to stop water. When the Israelites were leaving Egypt, the Red Sea, led by Moses, and now crossing into the Promised Land, led by Joshua. But what we see, the crossing of the Jordan River is not just in chapter 3. The crossing of the Jordan River is actually a narrative that spans from chapter 3 all the way to the end of chapter 5. In chapter 3, what we have is the crossing of the Jordan following the Ark of the Covenant. In chapter 4, we have erecting stones as a memorial of the covenant. And in chapter 5, we have the reinstitution of circumcision as a kind of reviewing of this covenant. So it seems thematically that there's a point that's happening here in the crossing of the Jordan. It's a reiteration of the covenant of God, or we could use the term promise of God. What did he promise them? That they would have the land. So before they go, it's remember, you'll have the land, Ark of the Covenant. Oh, you got there? Set up some stones to remember that you'll have the land. How are you going to know once you leave where you can't see the stones anymore? Circumcision as a sign of the covenant. I promised you'd have this. So I'm going to make a real clear point over three chapters, you're going to have it. But things get progressively worse for Israel. Things get progressively more complicated for Israel. Situations get progressively more complicated and complex and difficult. So listen to this quote by Arthur Pink on this passage. He says, quote, God does not bid them to trust him with all their hearts and lean not unto their own understanding until he has given them clear proof that he is fully worthy of that confidence. He does not call upon them to overcome the world, to mortify their lusts and resist the devil until he has strengthened them with might by his spirit in the inner man. He does not exhort them to tread the path of much tribulation, which alone conducts to glory, without first weaning their hearts from this world, giving a death wound to their love of sin, and granting them a ravishing earnest for that glory. How gracious is the Lord, and how tender are his ways. And that's what we see this morning with the crossing of the Jordan. Before he says, remember, I'm going to tell you to walk around a city 7 times. I'm going to help you cross a river. Before he says, go and defeat the most fierce army in the land, I'm going to show you what I can do with water. He says, before I'm going to send you to do great things, I'm going to show you that you can trust me in small things. And that's what we see this morning. This passage in Joshua elicits great comfort and encouragement from our great God, specifically in the Ark of the Covenant. We'll see three things as we go through this passage. First, we will see the rule of God in the Ark. The rule of God in the Ark. Second, we will see the guidance of God in the Ark. And third, we will see the supremacy of God in the Ark. Throughout these great things, we will see a reality that should change and shape our daily lives. You ready? Okay, cool. The rule of God in the Ark. This is verses 2-4. After 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God carried by the Levitical priests, you are to break camp and follow it. But keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between yourself and the ark. Don't go near it so that you can see which way to go, for you haven't gone this way before." Okay? If you remember from the book of Exodus, chapter 25, God commands the Israelites to build him a place to live. They called it the tabernacle, or the tent of meeting. If you remember from Exodus 25, there's something that exists right in the middle of the tabernacle. And it's a cube room called the Holy of Holies, and something exists within that room, the Ark of the Covenant. So you've got the nation of Israel camped around a tent, which is around another room, which is around the Holy, or around the Ark of the Covenant. And here, what we see is this Ark of the Covenant. And what we see in Exodus 25, 22, it says, "I will meet you, God, I will meet you there above the mercy seat, between the two cherubim that are over the Ark of the Testimony, Ark of the Covenant. I will speak with you from there all that I command regarding the Israelites." So all the way back from the wandering in the wilderness, the Ark of the Covenant represented the presence of God with his people. That's where God spoke with Moses, at the Ark of the Covenant. It represented the presence of God. And that's all fine, right? We can say that. We can be like, okay, Ark of the Covenant means the presence of God. But why are there specific instructions? That says it here, break camp. When you see it, break camp. Why? Why couldn't they break camp first? Okay, it's pretty important. The camp was built around the ark. All 12 tribes spread out around it. Numbers chapter 2, verse 17. The Ark of the Covenant inside the Holy of Holies, inside the Tent of Meeting, was positioned inside all 12 of the tribes. So for them to break camp prematurely would be, the tent isn't done yet. For them to move anywhere, if we read through Genesis to Deuteronomy, the tent of meeting was torn down and gotten ready to move first, and then the camps would break. Because the presence of God rests within the ark. But then they were told to stay back 1,000 yards. That's quite a distance. 1,000 yards. Why? Why is that distance significant? There's a document. It's less of a document and more of a rock. And by that I mean it's a tablet that had Hittite cuneiform scratched into it. Okay? So sort of like a document, sort of like a rock. And on this tablet, it's called Instructions for the Royal Bodyguard. Okay? This tablet of Hittite cuneiform predates the book of Joshua. It existed before Joshua was written. And in that, or on that, rather, tablet, it talks about how you would encamp around a king or a general, and that whenever they got ready to move out, you would break your camps and follow them. It also talks about, because they were leading the army was told to stay back almost 1,000 yards. so that you could see where they were going. So if that's how in the ancient Near Eastern world, armies and nations were intended to follow their rulers, and here we see, when you see the Ark of the Covenant, break your camp and follow it, but keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between you and the Ark, what is it saying? The Ark, i.e. the presence of God, is the ruler that is leading the people across the Jordan. He is the king. God himself, represented in the Ark of the Covenant, is the king of Israel leading his people across the river. All of these things confirm that. They built their camp around it. They could only break whenever it was ready to go. Stay back. Why? That's how it worked culturally. This is the king leading his people. This should lead us to do something. This should lead us to humble praise. Psalm 95. Come, let us shout joyfully to the Lord. Shout triumphantly to the rock of our salvation. Let us enter his presence with thanksgiving. Let us shout triumphantly to him in song. For the Lord is a great God, a great king above all gods. The depth of the earth are in his hands, and the mountain peaks are his. The sea is his. He made it. He formed the dry land. Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker. For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the sheep under his care. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your heart as at Meribah, as it was on that day at Massa in the wilderness where your fathers tested me. They tried me, though they had seen what I did for 40 years. I was disgusted with that generation. I said, they are a people whose hearts go astray. They do not know my ways. So I swore in my anger, they will not enter my rest. But here we have the next generation entering the rest. And how did they do that? Because they acknowledged and submitted themselves to the rule of God in the ark. This should also lead us to faithful service of that king. Colossians chapter 3, verses 23 says, whatever you do, do it as to the Lord, not to men. These people did not serve Joshua. They served him in a sense of him being established. But just like we saw in chapter 1, when Joshua spoke, they were obeying or disobeying God, not Joshua. Whatever you do, work for the Lord, not for man. This should lead us, by acknowledging and recognizing the rule of God in the ark, to humble praise and to faithful service. But then we see the guidance of God in the ark. This is verses 5 to 11. Consecrate yourselves before the Lord. When you get to the Jordan River, go ahead and stop. That's what Joshua says. He told the Israelites, come, listen. Listen to what God said. Listen to what God said, verse 10. He said, you will know that the living God is among you and that he will certainly dispose before you all these people when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and the whole earth goes ahead of you into the Jordan. Okay. How do you know, Israel, that the living God is among you? How are you going to know? Is it when you get to the other side of the Jordan? No. Is it when all of the enemies are gone? No. Is it when all the roadblocks get out of the way and everything's smooth sailing? No. What does it say? It actually says it. He said, you will know when the living God is among you and that he will certainly dispose before you the Canaanites, Hethites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. How will you know? You will know when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of the whole earth goes ahead of you into the Jordan. How do you know the living God is real and moves among you? When he guides you. When he goes before you into the places that he has called you to go. Not when it's easy, Not when there's no conflict. Not when everything's peachy and wonderful and everything's prosperous and great. How do you know? When the ark moves into the Jordan. But this is what you might say. You might say, okay, I know my life. What if he guides me in the wrong way? What if he guided me into something that maybe he made a mistake? Felt weird to say that. But maybe you think that. Or maybe what you think is, I wasn't following and I made a decision. And now it's not turning out great. Okay, those are very real things. Okay, a couple things. Number one, the Lord does all his will. Okay, let's just get that clear right out of the gate. Okay, this is going to be exactly what the ladies are studying in the book of Esther. Okay, the Lord does all his will. Isaiah says it repeatedly. I am the Lord, that is my name. I do not share my glory with another. That means you don't have that much authority. You don't have that much power in your life to say, I don't want to go where you will. I want to go where I... He's, no, because that's where he wants you to go. Why? Because I do all my will, God says. I'm the one who separated the end from the beginning. That's what God says. I'm the one who established what was and what was not, God says. There is no will in this world that originates anywhere other than God. Because he is the only will that originated from nothing. God will do all he will. So don't think, oh, I didn't follow God. I went against his... No, you went exactly where he wanted you to go. Because God does everything he wants to do. And you don't have that much power in your life. Number two, what if he led in the wrong way? Some people might think that. What do the Proverbs say, though? There's a way that seems right to a man, and where does it lead? Death and destruction. This is going to sound a little bit harsh, maybe a little bit blunt, but it's very true. You don't know the best way to go. You have no idea. Just like the Israelites, it literally says it. You need to see the ark. Why? Because you haven't gone this way before. You don't know the best way to go. If it were up to the Israelites, they wouldn't have gone that way, would they? Probably not. They've never gone that way before. So why would they say, which way do I go? The way that I've been before or the way that I haven't been before? That looks better. Doesn't make any sense. They wouldn't have gone that way. Especially considering, what does it say? The river overflows in the harvest season. And they crossed opposite of Jericho, right? If you went up like 5 miles, you could step across the river. But no, God says, go this way. At this time. In this place. Why? Probably because you wouldn't have gone this way and it's harder. That's why he went this way. They would have chosen the easy way. They would have chosen the happy way, the one that avoids all the difficulties. You would too. And if you were honest with yourself, you know that you would. I would. So we all do. You want the path of least resistance. I want the path of least resistance. So when there's any sort of resistance, our brains automatically say, oh, I didn't trust God, or God led me in the wrong way. Or maybe whenever we're like, oh, God doesn't do bad things, then we automatically blame the enemy of God. Oh, there's resistance. It must be a spiritual attack. Right? There's no enemy here, though, in Joshua chapter 3. I mean, there's enemies, but not in the crossing of the Jordan. Right? Satan's not here being like, make sure you take the ark over here. It's going to be really difficult. God told him to do that. Why would God tell them to do that? There's rapids here. There's things that you can get dead by. Why would God tell them to do that? Maybe so that they would trust God. Maybe so that they would trust in his promises. Romans chapter 4, verse 21, we see a theological exposition of Abraham from Paul. Abraham trusted in the promises of God. What does it say? 4:21. Abraham believed. Why? Verse 21. Because he was fully convinced that what God has promised, he was also able to accomplish. God promised that they would get across the river. Did it matter which way they went? No. God told them they'd get there. All they had to do was follow the ark. And here we see the guidance of God in the ark, and that should lead us in our lives to trust the promises of God. He doesn't promise things he's not able to do, because that would be a lie. It should also lead us, very difficultly, to submit to God all of the sorrows of our life. 1 Samuel chapter 3. So Samuel told him, Eli, everything and did not hide anything from him. This is what Eli responded. Eli was the mentor of Samuel, the prophet. What did Eli respond? He is the Lord. He's going to do whatever he thinks is good. We don't think that way. We don't think that. We think bad things means God did something wrong, or we did something wrong, or something spiritual is happening that's causing problems. What if that's not true? What if that's not true in your life, where difficulties and roadblocks and rapids crossing a river are actually God saying, watch what I can do? Like the Israelites crossing the Jordan River. And all we have to do is follow the ark. And that leads us to the third point here, the supremacy of God in the ark. Verses 14 to 17. When they broke camp and crossed the Jordan, the priests carried the Ark of the Covenant ahead of the people. That's what they were supposed to do, so that's a good thing that they did that. Now the Jordan overflows its banks in the harvest season. That's problematic. But as soon as the priests carried the Ark, it reached the Jordan, their feet touched the water's edge, and the water flowing downstream stood still, rising up in a mass from Adam to Zarethan. That's quite a distance. That's like 3 miles. So from Adam to Zarephath, it rose up. It stopped. And the water flowing downstream stopped. And it stopped on both sides of them. Nothing was moving anymore. And they walked across on dry ground. It's crazy. But it's even crazier when we talk about the culture of what's happening here. Right? Did you know, or do you know, the name of the chief god in Canaan, the land that they're going into? His name, according to documents, is El, E-L, which the Israelites then adopted, the name of the supreme god. It means, in Ugaritic, the language of Canaan, it means the supreme one, El. So we get the names of God, El Shaddai, El, you know, all these things. The supreme God who does this, the supreme God who does this, the supreme God who does this. El is the name of the Canaanite God. And that's on the west side of the Jordan. On the east side of the Jordan, there was a counterpart God in the territory of Babylon named Marduk. They're more or less the same thing, same gods per se. Okay, they were responsible for something very important. These gods, these supreme gods, Marduk on the east side and El on the west side, okay? They were responsible for something very important. Ready? Keeping the river flowing. Why? Because it overflowed in harvest season, and that produced fertility on both sides of the river. So the gods of the land they were coming from and the god of the land they were going to had one primary job: make sure the water kept going. But then the rule of God in the ark and the guidance of God in the ark does what? I'm better than you. That's what he says. He gets in and says, you have one job, right? Make sure the river flows. I have one job. Make sure you don't do what you're supposed to do. And he stops the water. He does the exact opposite of what both sides of the river worship. They worship gods that make it go. Israel worships a god that's better than those. And that's what we see. The God of Israel is supreme above any other false god, whether they have names, Marduk and El, or whether they don't, like money, or power, or position, or idealism. God is supreme over all of these things. This whole story serves to encourage the person of God, to encourage them in their lives, both to cross the Jordan and today. You may have things in your life that are in front of you that may seem insurmountable. In a lot of ways, kind of like an overflowing rapid river that you look at and you get scared. Maybe your marriage is fractured. Maybe you're looking at your children and thinking, oh, better not. Right? There's a lot of things going on in our lives. Maybe it feels like everything in your life is caving in and breathing room is at a premium. Right? Like if you take another breath in the wrong direction, you're going to suck up all the oxygen in the room. There's a lot of things facing us, but know this. The Lord who rules in the ark, who guides in the ark, and is supreme over all false gods, does not call you to things and then leave you alone. He does not call you to things and leave you alone. Okay, a little bit of a newsflash. If you have children, you have been called to be a parent. Okay? There's no way to get around that. Okay, it's not like God made a mistake. Therefore, the Lord does not call you to something and then leave you alone. He rules in his presence, he guides you in what he calls you towards, and he is supreme over everything in it. If you are married, God has called you to be married. And it's not like all of a sudden he said, be married, I'm out now. He rules in his presence, he guides, and he is supreme over every false thing that comes in that seeks to wreak havoc on that call. The Lord does not call us to things and then leave us alone in them. Okay, here's another thing. The Lord does not call you to something that necessitates you neglect something else he has called you to. Okay? Just like what we see here, the Levites were given the call, the job of carrying the ark. The Israelites were also called to cross the Jordan. Both of those calls are true. And the Lord does not leave you alone in either of them, and he does not call you to something that makes you neglect something else he called you to. This is a prime example of this. You may have heard a lot. I'll use myself as an example. A prime example. Oftentimes, there are stigmas around pastors' children. Okay? It's now used as like a slander. Okay? Like, oh, you're a pastor's kid. Like, If the Lord called me to be a parent, and he also called me to be a pastor, both of those things can be done well. Does that make sense? Yes. Okay. Does that mean I always do them well? No. But they both can be done well. If the Lord has called you to be married and then called you to have children, both of those things can be done well. If the Lord has called you to be married and not called you to be children, but called you to serve, called you to work, called you to do things in society, both of those things can be done well. Because the call of God does not negate the other call of God. Because he is supreme and he guides and he rules in those things. So let's not think for a moment that all of a sudden, because there's difficulty, because the rapids are there, because the river's overflowing, something's wrong. It doesn't have to be that case. That could have been the case very easily. We could have thought something was wrong whenever there's a barrier between the wilderness of sin and the promised rest of the gospel. Something's wrong. We can't get across the river to salvation. Something must not be right here. But no. This is the eternal plan of the Father. We just sang it, right? Come behold the wondrous mystery. The Father's plan unfolds, bringing many sons to glory, grace unmeasured, love untold. And what we see is the rest of God out of reach. The promised land of eternal security out of reach for people because the rapids are so big. It required the presence of God, the guidance of God, and the supremacy of God. In the very thing that represents or is the presence of God with his people, that holds his laws together, that holds his miracles together, and that holds his sustenance together, and that happened in the incarnation of the person of Jesus Christ. That's where it happened. And on that Friday, though, it seemed like the rapids weren't stopped. Seems like the water just crashed over that ark standing in the middle. For 3 days, we're standing on the wilderness side of the river looking at what was supposed to be the thing that provided a way across to the rest of God, and we're left in a position of potentially feeling hopeless of things. But then 3 days later, in the resurrection of Jesus, his supremacy stopped the river. His supremacy stopped it and provided sure and dry access across the barrier that we could not cross. And we're able to enter by his rule, his guidance, and his supremacy into the promised land, into the rest that God offers by Christ. Now, as I was reflecting on this week, a hymn from my childhood came to mind. Maybe you've heard it, maybe not. Probably not. There's like 4 places where it's printed. It's by a guy named Josiah Candor, written in 1824. It's called The Lord is King. And I want you to listen to this. Close your eyes if you want to. Just listen to this hymn. The Lord is King. Lift up your voice. O earth and all ye heavens, rejoice. From world to world the joy shall ring, the Lord omnipotent is King. The Lord is King, who then shall dare resist his will, distrust his care, or murmur at his wise decrees, or doubt his royal promises? The Lord is King, child of the dust, the judge of all the earth is just. Holy and true are all his ways, let every creature speak his praise. He reigns, ye saint, exalt your strains, your God is King, your Father reigns. He is at the Father's side, the man of love, the crucified. Come, make your wants, your burdens known. He will present them at his throne, and angel bands are waiting there, his messages of love to bear. Oh, when this wisdom can mistake, his might decay, his love forsake, then may his children cease to sing, the Lord omnipotent is king. Alike pervaded by his eye, all parts of his dominion lie. This world of ours, the world's unseen, and thin the boundary in between. One Lord, one empire, all secure. He reigns, and life and death are yours. Through earth and heaven one song shall ring, the Lord omnipotent is king. Father, I praise you. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today the ways that we may know you and be sustained. Forgive us for ways that we have doubted your promises. Forgive us for ways that we've blamed you for difficulties or considered ourselves above your sovereign will. God, I pray for everyone that we would submit ourselves, have humble praise and faithful service and trust in the great promises that you've placed before us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Would you